So there I was, sitting at my desk at my dream job, which was being tech support for Psygnosis, the video game company that had been such a big part of my late teenage years and which had inspired me so much as to how beautiful games could be. And my job was going to be to answer the phone and answer questions about Psygnosis games as if I was the expert, the guru on the hill that the players came to get their hints. So my supervisor, Chris, had me wait until the phone rang, and it didn't take very long. And the phone rang, and I picked it up and said, "Hello, Psygnosis helpline, how can I help you?" And the person started telling me that they were playing this game, Lemmings, and that they had gotten up to a few levels higher and then discovered that there were satanic images and satanic symbols all throughout the game. And what could they do? Was there any way to take the Satan out of the Lemmings game? And I immediately said, "Please hold." And I look at Chris and I say, "Oh, you won't believe this. I got a nut the first time out. They want to know about the satanic symbols in Lemmings, and what can we do to get rid of them?" And Chris looked at me and said, "Oh no, they're correct. There are satanic symbols in Lemmings. What we normally do is just offer them a free copy of something else in return for giving us back the Lemmings game." So I had to turn to the phone, pick it up, and apologize for all of that Satan. This is Jason Scott. You're listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about technology, stories, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Brenda Romero, Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters who have helped me get slowly out of debt. Psygnosis was a company that thrived in the UK from the mid-1980s until about 2000, when it lost that wonderful name and became simply another Sony studio. But in that period of time, they had produced some of the most beautiful, engaging, and haunting games. They were not always the best games. That is to say, they weren't filled with the depths that you could find in other works. But there was an artistry and a mysteriousness about them that just really grabbed you. I mean, if you booted in Shadow of the Beast or Lemmings or something like The Killing Game Show, you were just blown away by the graphics that your machine was capable of. And to be honest, they functioned best as a demo, as something that you popped in with no words in front of your friend and then just said, "Sit back and enjoy it." When I got hired by Psygnosis, it was a complete fluke. I was working in a jewelry company as a temp, and the temp company said, "You know, this other place is looking for someone who knows DOS. Maybe you'll do it?" And since I was quitting no matter what, I said, "Sure, I'd do something with tech support." And they said, "Great, it's a company called Psygnosis." And it was like a whole portion of my childhood came rushing back, and I just said, "This can't possibly be the same Psygnosis." It was a division of Psygnosis that had been brought up in Brookline, Massachusetts, and then moved up to the sixth floor of a building in the middle of Central Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they needed a tech support person. I was interviewed very quickly on the phone by Chris, who became my direct supervisor. And like a lot of video game companies, there wasn't anything particularly spectacular about the Psygnosis offices. These were offices on the sixth floor of a building, windows out into a nondescript city, and just a bunch of desks. Somewhere here and there, you might see some Psygnosis art. Certainly, there was a logo out in the reception area, but generally, it was just little rooms, little desks, and phones. My desk was out in the open. When you came in through the main floor, you would just be looking at the back part of my desk. It had a bulletin board, it had a computer, it had a phone, and it had a little space for me to keep binders. And when I sat down there in the morning, my job was to pick up the phone and check the answering machine, the literal answering machine we had, to see what people had left messages about, and then call them back. Usually people had a non-functioning piece of software, or they couldn't get it working, or they just needed a game hint of some sort. Now, a lot of other companies at that time had kind of figured out that you could charge people for hints, but Cygnosis US didn't do that. People would call and say, I can't get past this level in Lemmings. I can't get past this level in Shadow of the Beast. How do these controls work here? Why am I not able to fire enough bullets to get past this level? What's going on? Can you help me? And then we would just call them back and tell them what we knew, because you had these binders that had been built up over time with all of the walkthroughs, all of the answers. And so tech support was different every time. It could be anywhere in the country. Occasionally it was anywhere in the world. And I had to know on the fly how different DOS boxes function, how Amigas functioned, even how Atari STs functioned, to be able to get people up and going with their product. I worked at Cygnosis from about 1995 to 1996, about a year. It was a crazy, crazy year to be working there. Cygnosis was tapped by Sony to do a lot of the back-end development work for the PlayStation, which, at the time, was just hitting the market. Now, because I worked there, I had all sorts of insidery views of what the PlayStation was like compared to what it was being portrayed as. Here's some things that come off the top of my head. First of all, and I've had people dispute this, but if the PlayStation had not been a real success, it would have finished Sony. Sony wouldn't have gone bankrupt. We wouldn't have seen, you know, Sony go out of business. But the amount of money they had sunk into it to ensure that it was manufactured, and the amount of money they had lost on every single console, and the amount of money that they were going to have to sink years going forward, if that thing had not taken off, if it had been like a 3DO or even one of the Sega consoles and had not made what they needed it to make, Sony probably would have been selling off some pretty major assets to stay afloat. So there was a real tension at Sony that I don't think was really externally known. One of the side effects of this was that Sony hedged its bets. The development consoles, the ones that people were working on to make these initial releases of games, had 8 megabytes of RAM. That was a pretty solid amount for a really good audio player and a really good processor. It was a nice amount of memory to work in. Until, pretty close to production, Sony decided that they were going to make it 2 megabytes. They made it 2 megabytes just to make sure that they weren't completely losing their shirt on every single console. But you can imagine what happened to all of these different developers who discovered that they had 25% of the active memory that they expected. And what Sony did was they sent in Cygnosis developers with some of these companies to help them turn their large, perfectly reasonable games into minified versions that could work within this ridiculous limitation. So there's a game called Darkstalkers. I know that a couple characters were cut out of it. There's a game called The Adventures of Lomax, and it had something like 4 or 5 parallax backgrounds that scrolled at different rates. It was really something to look at, and they just simply had to cut out 3 or 4 of them. So there are versions of these games out there, I've seen them, that don't exist because they're made for a version of the Sony PlayStation that never came out. I hope somebody finds them someday. My apartment was located just down the street from the Cygnosis offices, so I have this really strong memory of getting up in the morning, walking down, stopping off at my favorite deli, getting a liter of Jolt Cola, a whole liter, and then just sipping at it all the way to work and then throughout the day, just working out the problems, helping people figure out why their machine didn't have enough memory, getting them acquainted with things like extended memory managers or setting the amount of open files to be able to run all of these programs. It was this adventure in helping people, and it was a habit that I picked up and I never got away from to this day. I mean, one of the things that you learn in tech support is that pretty much every problem is probably solvable, even if the solution is something drastic like machine replacement. You can sit with a person who's lost, who's unhappy, who just wants to play with their software and enjoy their game, and after some steps through understanding their system and what they're trying to do, you can help them get things going. And even though some of the calls were angry and bitter, to help somebody who you're never going to meet, who's far across the country, and suddenly to hear the tones of the game blasting through their speakers, and you can hear the sigh of relief that their $30 wasn't wasted. I mean, I never got tired of that. It was a joy. Sometimes people were perhaps a little unreasonable. There was a woman who called to tell us that she kept ordering products from us and they never showed up at our house. And the fellow who worked in our mailroom, because at the time we shipped all of our software from the basement of this building, he took his job very seriously. And the idea that we were sending products out and they weren't arriving, that was a personal affront to his skill set. So I got all the information I could from her. And so after she gave me her address and we started to walk through everything she had ordered and how much of it had gotten there and when she had ordered it and everything else, my coworker was on the case. And something like 3 or 4 days later, he came back and he was proud of himself, but he was also super annoyed. You see, this woman lived inside of a gated community, one of those places that has a gatehouse, and their rule was that no delivery van could actually enter the community. Instead, it would be signed for by the guard, and then the guard would hold it for the residents who would have to go down to the guardhouse. And she did not think that was reasonable, so she kept ordering everything and then reporting when it didn't get to her, because of course it had gotten to her, it was just waiting for her down at the guardhouse. And I guess she was trying to foment some sort of revolution or to become someone who they just gave up on and let every FedEx truck and UPS truck into this gated community. Anyway, I wasted 2 or 3 days on that. There was also another call, and I'll never forget this call as long as I live. She called us, and her system wasn't working, and normally I go through a few branches of the trouble-solving tree, and it's working for her. But her system was really odd. The floppy drive didn't work. It wasn't doing the right commands. I would tell her to type in, you know, DIR, and it would return the right command. And I would tell her to type mem, and it showed that it had enough memory. But whenever I asked her to type A:, and boot the machine, it didn't work. It was weird. And it was only after 2 hours of going through every possible problem did we finally figure out that every time I asked her to type A:, she was typing acorn. Acorn! Acorn! Like a tree, like a squirrel, like a nut. Like a nut that would fall out of a tree and be the joy of a squirrel. I really loved Psygnosis. I loved everything about it, and I loved the aesthetic that they put into their games. They had games for the PlayStation, like Wipeout, Destruction Derby. They had weird games for the PC, like Nova Storm or Estatica. And these games, they were just a few degrees off from being normal. And being able to take the calls from people as they wend their way through these games, I mean, it was so worth it. Something new every single day. Working for the U.S. subsidiary, I got to see Psygnosis games before they ever became products, and just to let you in, there are a number of products that went all the way through testing and totally worked well with Psygnosis, and they just made decisions, decisions I was not privy to, decisions that were never explained, and they would just simply choose to not publish something. They certainly scrupulously paid the developers to make the games, but then they would sit on them, and the games would languish and eventually become completely obsolete, and then would just disappear into the ether. I'm sure there are prototypes and unusual versions of programs that people know sitting inside of some boxes in someone's apartment in the UK. It'll be a great day when those get out there. Another thing I saw, when the PlayStation, the original PlayStation, came out, Sony did this extremely weird campaign. They put the PlayStation into dance clubs. They would rent out clubs and put PlayStations in them and have people play Wipeout to get them in the mood and to tell them this was a console that was going to appeal to the club crowd. The original Wipeout has Red Bull as a sponsor, which at the time, I remember seeing the Red Bull logo and thinking, oh man, I really wish they had gotten a real company up on the billboards. I didn't know Red Bull was a real company until years later. And they would bring these game systems into clubs, give them Red Bull, let them play Wipeout, and then convince people that this was the way to go in the future with your gaming needs. I found out just recently that this was actually done with the original game Simon, that pattern recognition color game, the round one with the four buttons. They brought them into discos and set them up, and people could play Simon in the club and be told, this is the future, and if you want to be groovy, you want to pick up Simon. So, nothing's new under the sun. But they went a little farther with the Sony PlayStation. And again, I've mentioned this before, people don't believe me, but one day I was looking around through some of the promotional materials around the PlayStation. You know, the PlayStation logo was on a whole bunch of weird items. They were on mugs and t-shirts. There were reprints and posters of advertisements that were in Europe, but not in the U.S. There was one that had two people with bloody noses, as if the game had blown them away, but it was also meant to be a reference to cocaine. And going through these promotional materials, I found this perforated sheet. And the perforated sheet was in little tiny centimeter squares. And I asked about this, and I found out that on the sly, somebody within Sony had made blotter paper. This was meant to have droppers put drugs on them, and people could pull apart this Sony PlayStation logo and get high off it. This was a real thing that Sony made and had, and maybe it was used, maybe it was never used, but I've held it in my hands. There was PlayStation drug paraphernalia. All of this was being done by the UK division of Sony, and I found out that there was a weird kind of dynamic happening between the Japanese division and the UK division. The US division was completely subservient to the others, but the UK division was driving the image and the logo and everything else to build up this weird kind of outlaw underground feel to the console. And jammed somewhere in the middle of that was Psygnosis. Here's something that a lot of people might not know. Psygnosis created something called the PsyQ, PSY-Q, and it was a back-end development system. And they did it for a number of consoles. I'm talking Nintendo, Sony, Atari, others. There was a little company who made the development units so that people could make prototypes on a quote-unquote regular machine like an SGI or a PC and then immediately port it over into a card version of the console so that they could see immediately if it worked. This sort of thing has been happening since basically the beginning. There are development kits for the Atari 2600 that ran on things like a VAX that would enable you to blow a cartridge image down and boot it off of an Atari 2600. I mean, everyone's been doing this. But Psygnosis had a business that it had done for years for people, including Sony's competitors, making development cards. And when I found that out, I just had so much more love for this company because they were willing to do anything with anyone at any time. Sony had bought Psygnosis in the early 1990s, and it was not a good marriage. I'm not that much of an insider to everything that went on, but to give you an idea about how contentious things got, at one point, Wipeout was meant to be the console-exclusive wonder of the PlayStation. It was hot. It was clubby. They got it into the Hackers movie by showing an SGI prototype. And then the head of Psygnosis went ahead and made a port of Wipeout for the PC and the Sega Saturn. Can you imagine somebody purchased by Nintendo turning around and making the new Nintendo platformer work in Steam? It happened. It absolutely happened. You know, I'm cherry-picking the really weird stuff that happened, but for the year that I was at Psygnosis, from when I was 25 to when I was 26, it was just so eye-opening after a lifetime of playing with video games and being a part of computer games to experience it from the point of view of a company. People would have lives. They'd have kids and families, and they would come into work and work on games of all sorts, right? We had PR people and sales people making deals with department stores or calling up magazines. We'd be getting back all of these customer service cards that people could fill out about what they liked or didn't like about the games. And of course, I was answering all sorts of technical support questions or bringing them to other people. There were releases that were coming that we learned about, that we sweated over. There was one case when we discovered that all of the copies of Discworld weren't working. They had some major flaw in them, and we were going to have to repackage them. So in the basement of Psygnosis on a weekend, all of the people who had the time, who could make it in, we had 10,000 copies of Discworld, and we opened them up, replaced the broken media with the working media, and resealed it. So if you ever had a copy of Discworld for the PC in the 1990s, I guarantee you that I personally touched it. We had a camaraderie. We had a real sense of being together, and I knew pretty much everybody at the company pretty well. I ate lunch with many of them. I hung out with them. We looked at new games together. We talked about what was going on in Cambridge and the world. And it was a real tight-knit little place. And so when Sony decided to move it, they did it in a really jerky way. And they sent somebody we'd never heard of for a quote-unquote special meeting. And as soon as he got there, he explained that we were going to be closed and that some of us were moving on to California. And most of us were fired that day, effective immediately. And I was one of the people who was tapped to stick around in the office for a little while to clean things up, and then ultimately was hired to work for a small startup that lived in that building afterwards. That's a story for another time. But right at the end there, right towards the end, there was some work being done to repackage some of the Psygnosis games, including one called Estatica, which was a very strange voxel-driven adventure game. And we were going to repackage it onto a CD-ROM and sell it through Kmart. And I had to put together the instruction manual in a text form because it was going to be such a cheap OEM version that it wasn't even going to have a printed instruction manual. So that fell on me. And when it got to the end of the text file and I knew the company was going away, I snuck in the names of everybody who was working at the company. Everybody who worked there, all of my friends who had done things with me for the last year, who were so welcoming and pleasant to this kid, this newbie who was just now moving into the permanent job market. And I just said, rest in peace, Cygnosis, my family, my friends, my goodness. This has been Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. I'm Jason Scott. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Sam Johnston, and the hundreds of other supporters who help make this podcast possible. These podcasts really help me financially during this period, and they're helping me get through a lot of different bills. So it's a little bit discomforting when I have to miss weeks because of illness, but there was no way I could speak, and I didn't want to do some weird cheap filler activity or anything else. I mean, you're connecting to this maybe to help me, but also because you want to hear stories. So if I can't talk, there's no point. It was tax time, and I worked with Rich. We put in all of the expenses, all of the deductions, and I owe a few $1,000s to the government for 2017. It's not a debilitating amount. It's only about $3,500, and I'm going to pay it up through to October. And if I can't get the money to pay it by October, I'll set up a payment plan. But considering the amounts of debts that have been wiped away by this podcast, you're not going to hear any complaints from me. This has been just such a journey, and it is so refreshing to be able to wake up and know that there's a way out, that there is a way to make things better. Rich is a really good guy, a really nice accountant to work with. If you ever want contact info for him, he's mostly licensed in the Northeast, and I can certainly put you in touch with him. Talk to you next week with a fully functioning voice.